Welcome to the Money and Marriage Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Nelson. My mission to empower millennial couples to make money moves that won't just improve your financial health, but strengthen your marriage as well. In this podcast, I share stories, tips, and tricks, both from my experience as a certified financial planner and from my own marriage, to help you and your spouse kick financial anxiety to the curb and use your money to create the lives you love together. Let's get started. Seven years ago today, I couldn't walk, or more accurately, I couldn't walk without crutches. I had broken my foot a few days earlier. I was in day two of the boot 7 years ago today, and I wasn't weight bearing for a few more weeks, and so I was sitting behind my computer and couldn't really go anywhere. which was interesting because I broke my foot the day before I launched this company 7 years ago. I kid you not, I had like just written my first blog post about why I was making this decision to go out on my own and what my financial planning practice was going to be about at the time. Spoiler alert, it's changed a little bit since then. Wrote the blog post and decided to go for a run to clear my head before I went and proofread it. The day before I launched, and I stepped on a rock in the middle of the road and broke my foot doing so, which was not the best story, but it was unfortunate. But here we are, right? And so literally, I kid you not, this was in the evening. It was too late to go to the doctor at that point in time. Like, I had crutches that I was able to use, it was too late to go get my boot at the time. So I literally hit. Published on that blog post the morning I started my company on November 7th, and then went right to the doctor to go get x-rayed and all that stuff, and spent my first full day in business in the doctor's office. But, you know, it's been a long time since then. 7 years is a long time. To help you put into context what was going on 7 years ago, when I got started, because you weren't around presumably when I broke my foot, 7 years ago was the 2016 presidential election. Literally, I started my company on Monday. The election was Tuesday. And if that feels like it was a million years ago, you were not the only one there, right? A lot has happened in the world over the past 7 years. And so I thought this would be kind of a good opportunity to just take a step back and share some of the things that I've learned in this journey. Incidentally, this podcast is actually 3 years old at this point. I launched the podcast in conjunction with my firm's 4-year birthday, so to speak. So I've been doing this for a few years now, which is exciting as well. But, you know, I've talked to, I don't even know how many hundreds of couples at this point in time. I stopped counting the number of couples I had worked with, whether it was a one-on-one thing or an ongoing thing, at 50. And that was several years ago. I've stopped counting the years that it's been since I stopped counting how many couples I've worked with. And I've learned a lot in all those conversations, and just with the experience I've developed along the way. And so, 7 biggest takeaways from my first 7 years in business. First and foremost is that spreadsheets are important in financial planning, but they are not the only thing that matters, right? Spreadsheets and the math part of a financial plan is a very, very critical piece to making good financial decisions, but it's not the only thing that matters, right? It is one input into the broader planning process, right? Things like planning around what keeps you up at night, right? The math and the spreadsheets might tell you that you should be investing your money in a certain way, or making this financial decision, or not buying a house until XYZ happen. But if the answer the spreadsheet gives you intimidates you to such a point where you're not going to take action on it, the spreadsheet's not much good, right? The spreadsheet only works if you actually follow through on it. And so some of the behavioral pieces, right, and the qualitative aspects about how confident you feel in the state of your plan, and how clear you are on where your money is, and how committed you are to following through, right? All of those factors are just as important, I find, right? That's not to say we should ignore the math, certainly, right? We want to have the math inform the action we're taking, but, you know, I started this company armed with my like old retro financial calculator and my spreadsheets, and I thought I was going to change the world with them. And turns out that's not the way the world works, right? Those are a component to a good financial plan, but they're not the only thing, right? The spreadsheet might tell you to focus on working on three goals at once and spread out your money and your accounts to optimize things. But I found just in my practice working with couples that the couples who make the fastest progress are the couples who focus on one thing at a time, by and large, right? That's what really moves the needle, because it gives you a much clearer target to set for yourselves. It can help you set some more short-term, like aggressive deadline goals that motivate you. It can help you not lose sight of things, right? Just with how long you are focusing on a particular thing for, right? Having one target that you're focused on really can help, right? And then, of course, right, there's the mission and vision statement component of this as well. We've talked about this before, most notably in episode 6 of this podcast. But, right, what, you know, money is something that is a means to an end, right? And what is it that we want to be using our money to create, right? We can't answer that in a spreadsheet, right? The answer to that doesn't fall in a spreadsheet, nor does a spreadsheet tell you how to learn how to manage money with your spouse either, right? Which is, of course, what we talk about in most of these episodes on this podcast. So lesson number one, takeaway number one, spreadsheets are one input to a good financial plan, but by no means are they the only input to a financial plan. Lesson number two is luckily something I learned very, very quickly, like in the first 3 or 4 months, and that is that clarity is everything, right? In terms of the clients that I'm working with, right? The first financial plan I wrote back in 2016, I kid you not, was 40 pages long, and it was perfect, right? It went through all the scenarios, we weighed pros and cons, there were graphs, there were pretty pictures, there was tables, right? Like the math was flawless, right? It laid out every possible scenario. It was a great plan. And then I met with the client a month later and they hadn't even looked at it because it was 40 pages long. So they didn't do anything with it, right? I answered all their questions in this document, at least as best I was able to. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But they just had no clarity in what they should do, right? I thought they were hiring me to give them all the answers and lay all the math out for them. What they wanted was a clear plan. What they wanted was for me to tell them, here's what to do, right? Or here's the pros and cons and here's how to think about the decision and help coach them through the decision-making process. They didn't hire me to give them 40 pages of graphs, right? The plan itself didn't do what it needed to do because it didn't inspire the client to take action. And you'll find that's a kind of a recurring theme in some of these lessons learned here. Clarity is everything, right? If you're not clear on what you should be doing, you should be reaching out to a financial planner. And if the financial planner isn't helping you get clear on what you're doing, right, that's a sign that things aren't working. And so, I mean, that was something that I learned pretty early on, that I needed to make sure I was really focusing on what the client needs, right? For my ongoing clients, like I often, like there's not necessarily a plan document, right? We have our immediate action items that we need to do. Like the plan model is always updated behind the scenes, right? So that as things change or we want to look to make a decision, I'm able to adjust things and help kind of coach them through it. But, right, we're focused on action, right? What are the action items you need to be doing? What do we need to do in order to accomplish your goals, right? That's ultimately what I'm most focused on these days. Lesson number three, investing is more than just investing in the stock market. There's a lot of ways that you can invest your time and energy and resources and money. And sometimes that will help you get a better return than you might get in the stock market. I want to be careful here, right? Because with any sort of investing, there's risk, right? You put money into something and there's a risk that it's going to go down in value. It could fall to zero. It could go up in value, right? We don't necessarily know. But, you know, when we talk about investing, when financial planners in particular talk about investing, typically we're talking about investing in the stock market and putting money in that. And that's something that everybody should be doing once you have taken care of the basic financial foundation stuff for your family. But there's other forms of investing you can be doing too, right? Particularly in the early stages of your career, investing in your human capital, in your education, in your skill set is some of the most impactful investing you can do, right? If you could take $10,000 and invest it in the stock market when you're 25 years old, right? That'll grow. Compound interest is a thing, right? It can work out really well. But like, if you can invest that in building a skill set that's going to help you get a $50,000 a year raise, right? When you have 40 years left in your career, and that raise compounds on itself over time, like that can be a huge, huge change to your financial situation. It can be a really, really, really good big impact if you're able to do that. I found that when I sat for my certified financial planner exam back in 2018 or 2019, I don't even remember at this point, right? I became a CFP, a certified financial planner, a few years into launching my firm. And right, that process was a huge time investment. It was a huge money investment to do all the coursework you needed to do. And I mean, I for a variety of reasons that caused my growth trajectory and my income and my firm to grow pretty quickly, right, once that happened. And, you know, that was an investment that I made in myself that wasn't in the stock market, but it's pretty clearly paid dividends, so to speak, metaphorical dividends, I suppose, for the purpose of this metaphor, right? And oftentimes you're in a situation where you might be able to do that too. Investing in your marriage is a really, really good way to invest money, right? Whether it's marriage counseling, whether it's time, whether it's date nights, right? Those are investments from my point of view, right? The easiest way to lose half of your wealth is to get divorced. And so if you're able to invest some money into helping to reduce the risk of that happening, right, that's a great investment to make. If you are depressed and struggling or have some sort of mental health thing going on, right, investing in therapy is a really great use of your financial resources. I tell my clients all the time, I don't view therapy as an expense. I view it as an investment for people. Now, you want to make sure you're getting an ROI from that investment, right? There may be a point in time when it really makes sense to invest in that, and a time where it might not make sense to do in that, right? That's for you to decide, certainly. But, you know, investing in yourself is a big part of that. And I've just seen how that's benefited, some of those things have benefited me, and certainly across my client base with people in all sorts of different family situations. Investing in yourself can be really big, right? So takeaway number one, spreadsheets are only one input to a financial plan. There's other stuff to pay attention to. Number two, clarity is everything. Number three, right, invest in yourself and view that as a form of investing. Takeaway number four for my first 7 years of business, and this is much more kind of my personal side of things. Don't be afraid of the financial therapy or financial counselor label, because I really was for a long time. I tell the story in my book, but you know, early on, maybe about a year or so, I don't even remember the dates all blend in at this point, but it was about a year or so after I got started. I remember I was wrapping up with a client who I'd been working with for a few months, and they said, "Wow, you know, Bill, when we hired you, we weren't expecting that we were going to hire a financial therapist. Like, this is actually kind of nice." And that freaked me out, right? Because I this was back when I was in my spreadsheets, right? I thought I was going to solve all the problems my clients had with the numbers on the page. And, you know, my immediate reaction to the term financial therapist was, no, I don't do that, right? I'm very type A. I like my numbers, right? That's how we're approaching things. I'm not some woo-woo, like hippie financial planner. And then I heard it again from a different client a few months later. And it was kind of odd how many clients were making that sort of comment to me, right? Whether it was a financial therapist or financial counselor. And I eventually came to realize that what they were meant by that, they weren't like saying I was a therapist or I was a counselor, but what they were getting at was that I was asking really good questions and just listening to their responses and using that to kind of guide how we're moving forward. But like that freaked me out for a long time. And ultimately, I've really come to embrace that, right? I've gone to get the Certified Financial Therapist 1 designation. I'm using those skills, and I've actively looked to build out some of those skills. And obviously that's what we talk about here on this podcast, right? I have a podcast not just about the spreadsheets, but about money and marriage and how those two topics intersect. But I was worried about kind of going down that road. Like I was really kind of repelled by it for a while. Because I'm not the hippie financial planner, right? I guess I am in some ways, right? But I'm at heart, like I'm not super woo-woo, right? I still like my spreadsheets at the end of the day, but I've learned how to pull some of those techniques into my practice, and I've seen my clients really benefit from the result. So takeaway number four, right? Don't be afraid of that financial therapy label, right? Understand what it means and what it doesn't, and what my professional boundaries need to be. but it took me a while to understand what my clients meant when they were saying things unprompted by me to that degree and in that regard, and I've learned certainly from that over time. Relatedly, number five, stop talking, start listening. Right, that's my takeaway. Right, that's takeaway number five. Stop talking and start listening. Don't stop listening. Start listening. I've been doing this podcast enough that I've had podcast listeners reach out to me and schedule intro calls with me, and I've talked to people who got to know me through this podcast, and you know, one of the things that they've often have remarked is that they've been surprised at how little I talk, right? I mean, you know, I didn't do the math on this beforehand, right? But there's been about 115 episodes of this podcast out, and they're all 15-ish minutes each, right? That's I'm doing the math now. That's almost 30 hours of content that I put out here on this podcast, right? If you've gone and listened to all of these podcast episodes, first of all, God bless you. And second of all, you've listened to me talk for a long time. And I don't talk that much in my client meetings. I mean, I do when I need to, but I kind of got to this in the piece about asking good questions, right? I view my job is to ask the questions that get you to think about what the right answer is. I found early on, this honestly could even be a takeaway on its own, I didn't have this in the outline, but if I could get a client to answer their own question themselves, it oftentimes they'd be much more likely to actually follow through on the answer to the question, right? In other words, if you come to me and say, what should I do with my money? I can tell you exactly what to do with your money, right? But I'm going to have a few follow-up questions first, and I want to listen to your responses. And B, if I can then use your responses to kind of guide you to the answer yourself, you are much, much more likely to actually do the things that you should be doing with your money than you are if I just come in and tell you what to do and say take it or leave it, and you think about it and nothing happens, right? The process I think I'm really good in meetings like that at asking good questions, listening to responses, and using that as a way to kind of guide people to the right answers and give them the answers they're looking for. I am notorious for answering questions with questions in my meetings, and there's always a reason for it. And I think sometimes it can take some getting used to for that. But I mean, I've had intro calls with people, and they've been, I think, almost taken aback at how much listening I do, which is kind of sad, I think, when we think about the state of what that says about my industry, right? Where my industry is very good at handing out prescriptions, but not always good at listening and getting the diagnosis right, as we've talked about here before. Right. So that was a big takeaway for me. And I learned that over time, certainly, right? Stop talking, start listening, right? If I put out a 15-minute podcast, right, that I might talk during that amount of time, the same amount of time I'd spend talking in an hour-long client meeting, right? That really is what I try to shoot for. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. I'm sure I probably talk a little bit more than I realize, but I've gotten that feedback before, right? That people come to meetings and it can feel like talk therapy sometimes. It's not talk therapy. It's financial planning done right, in my opinion, but it can feel that way, and there is a reason for it. So that's takeaway number five. Stop talking, start listening. And I think that obviously can be beneficial in a lot of areas of your life. Takeaway number six, I don't have a good couple word phrase to sum this one up, but I guess if I could put a sentence on it, right? Think about all the various aspects of your career or the job that you have and balance them appropriately. What do I mean by that, right? In the job I had right out of college, right, before I went off into the financial planning world, right, one of the bosses at that job, one of the managing partners, used to give a presentation on career development, right, how to find the right job for you, that kind of thing. And she would draw out this circle map, right? If you can picture drawing 8 or 9 or 10 circles so that they all form a circle, right? So that we have a ring of circles, so to speak. And she'd write in each of them a component of your job, right? You know, your responsibilities, your hours, your boss, your coworkers, your, like, are you making an impact? Are you happy with what you're doing? Are you bored? Right? All of the different things that go into whether, like, you like your job or not. Your commute, right? Like, all these different pieces of your job that kind of come together to form the collective experience that you have in your job. And, you know, what she said is that, you know, and it stuck with me, is that, you know, you might make a job change or a career change, right, expecting it's going to solve all your problems, but you need to pay attention to how all those circles are interacting with each other. And when you make a move like that, what gets better and what gets worse over time? Honestly, I feel like I should do a whole separate podcast on this particular question. Maybe I'll do that sometime in the next few weeks here. But, you know, like, if people will change jobs and find that it's not necessarily the solution they were looking for, the grass isn't always greener on the other side. And it's because, right, like, even if you're in a job that you don't like, you know, maybe your coworkers are awesome. And if you change your job and your coworkers aren't so awesome, or you don't have any coworkers and you're working from home and realize that you like to be social and you have a hard time with that, right? That can create some challenges for you. And it took me a while to find the right balance of these things on this career wheel, so to speak, for me, once I went out on my own. I am pretty social. I am pretty outgoing. I like having coworkers and things like that. And when I made this transition to working on my own, I made some things pretty good, right? My boss, sometimes I really like my boss, which is me, obviously. Sometimes I really don't like my boss, which is me. But overall, right, I didn't have a boss that I had to answer to, right, other than myself. You know, my income went to zero when I got started. That's another income and salary, of course, is another circle, right, that we're balancing here. And that went to zero right out of the gate. So that one wasn't so good. My work-life balance went down in the short term, and it's a lot better now that I'm more well-established and I can take time off when my daughter gets sick. And, you know, we can do it, like, you know, right now my life is very flexible, but it took several years of hard work to get to that point. And I think I made this transition with the expectation that, like, everything about my job was going to be awesome. And a lot of those circles improved, right? The quality of work that I was doing, the passion I had for it, the impact I was having, right? All those things went up. But I was really lonely for a while working from home, like, and working on my own. I had to go kind of seek out some people to network with and collaborate with and run problems by and just, like, socialize with. The work-life balance piece was a challenge for a while, certainly, and sometimes it still is. But, you know, pay attention to those, the how those weaker areas in your career, the things that you don't like about your job, are changing over time, and really think about how to find the right balance across all those things. And recognize that when you get a job offer or when you're looking for new opportunities, that some of the areas in that wheel are going to get better, but some of them might get worse, and understand the trade-offs there, and don't be caught off guard. If you really, really, really just hate your boss and want to be doing something else, like, you might change jobs and your boss might be awesome, but your life might be worse overall, right? If you've made sacrifices on the commute and work-life balance and how much pressure your job has and your salary went down, or, you know, like, I mean, you can come up with your own scenarios for that. I think I am going to do a podcast on that topic sometime soon, because I think it is something that's worth thinking through. But that's takeaway number six. And then the last takeaway from my 7 years in business, the seventh takeaway here, is that I've kind of touched on this a little bit in passing in a few of these, right? But the financial plan itself, it is less important than financial planning, right? The process of going through financial planning and doing ongoing financial planning is what's valuable for people, right? It's not, quote unquote, the financial plan, right? Like that 40-page document that I wrote back in 2016 that's now much more streamlined and much more checklist focused and much more, like, easier to implement. Because a financial plan goes out of date very quickly, right? I can tell you how much money you need to have set aside to retire when you're 65, right? And let's say that number is $1,732,925.34. Like, I can calculate that number for you. And the only thing I can guarantee you, if you are not 64 years old, is that number is wrong, right? If you're 30 years old and you're 35 years away from retirement, we might expect that you need $1,732,925.34 to retire. But the only thing I can guarantee you is that you're not going to need exactly $1,732,925.34 by the time you retire, right? We don't know what your cable bill is going to be 35 years from now. Maybe that's probably a really bad example. We might not have cable then, right? But, you know, we don't know what your electric bill is going to be 35 years from now, right? We can't calculate with any sort of precision that number. And I can write a plan that says, here's what you need to do to retire at 65 and save up that long dollar amount. Or we can go through a process and get clear on the types of things you're going to need to do and how to keep it on track over time so that as things change, not if things change, but as things change, as you get new job offers, as you decide to move, as you have kids, as you have your expenses change, right? As you inherit money or, you know, whatever it might be, we can adapt, right? That process of going through and creating the plan is what is most valuable to the people that I work with, right? As opposed to like the financial plan itself. We still do the plan, right? Because it does give you those initial answers and it tells you the steps that you should be taking. But understand that map, that roadmap can get outdated pretty quickly. And it's the process of going through and really working on creating a plan that's going to lead you to live the life that you love with your spouse. Like, that's the important piece. It's the process and the skill set that you build as a couple in putting this together that's really important and that's really beneficial, right? And the process of course correcting and figuring out what to optimize along that journey and ways we can save on taxes or ways we can increase the ROI of the money that you're bringing in by making XYZ moves and figuring out how to handle really complicated big stakes decisions that come along the way. Like, that process of planning is so important, right? That's the piece that really moves the needle for people. I'm a financial planner. I do financial planning. I also write financial plans, but to me, like, it's the planning that really, really, really makes the biggest difference. So this has been a longer episode than I think I envisioned initially. Hopefully you found it helpful in terms of thinking through ways to think about making financial decisions for your family. We talked a little bit about investing. We talked a little bit about the financial therapy side of things. We talked about a little bit about careers and jobs and just how to approach long-term financial planning. Hopefully you got something out of it, and we will see you next week. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Money and Marriage Podcast. If you want to learn more, you can access my favorite money exercise for free if you head to paysetterplanning.com/moneyandmarriage. Again, that's paysetterplanning.com/moneyandmarriage. Get your access today, and I'll see you next time.